Welcome to Blind Faith, a podcast exploring thoughts about God and life in this world. Today, we've got an addition to the podcast, Josh Edwards.
Yo.
He teaches here at Life Pacific, and we also have Chandler, our producer, is jumping on the microphone.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
You've heard him on the commercials, and...
He's on a commercial?
Yeah.
What are you guys commercializing already?
If you
you're
don't
commercializing
know,
your blind faith, is that what you're doing?
If you don't know, okay. Sorry. So we're doing a story right now about an experience I had. My wife and I were going through missionary training when we were getting ready to deploy and be sent. And one of the things we did was some ministry with a church in LA, and they were doing some outreach in South Central LA, portion of South Central LA, an under-resourced neighborhood. And this is one of those stories that just illustrates how people often think, wait, are you really disabled? Oh, you're not really disabled. And I have those experiences all the time. They're like, are you really blind? They don't believe me. One of my friends, when I was in college, would always say, you're a seer, because he loved that word from the Old Testament prophets. Uh-huh. Oh, you're a seer. I'm like, yes, but no. but this story, my wife and I were walking with this church, and we were going like block by block and just knocking on doors, seeing how we could help. And as we're walking around, some of the kids would come and join and get some stuff with us, and then they'd go back with the church to their Saturday afternoon Sunday school thing. And so this one kid was super curious, and he did not believe that I was blind. So he's walking with us, full on, double barrel, middle fingers.
Bang, bang, is that what they said?
He was doing it silently, so I didn't know.
Oh, okay, yeah, sorry, go on.
So, but yes, that's what he was expecting, some kind of reaction like that.
Yeah.
And it went for like 10 minutes.
Man, he really took you to a gun show, huh? Sorry, go on.
I think he was trying to get some kind of reaction, and he was certain that I was faking it, even though I had a white cane, and you wouldn't think, but maybe because he thought I was walking at whatever pace and keeping up with my wife and the rest of the group that was in that neighborhood, but for like 10 minutes, and my wife is like, I'm not gonna give him the reaction he's looking for, and other people are looking at us like, are you gonna say something to him so he stops doing this? And so I don't know what you guys would do if you see some kid, 10-12 year old kid, just totally for like just not stopping, like, here you are, two middle fingers right in this guy's face to see, like, is he really blind? I don't know what you guys would do.
What would I do if a little kid just gave me two big old fingers?
Well, you wouldn't see it, but like if you're walking with me.
Yeah, if I saw it while I was walking with you.
Yeah.
There might be a few things I would do. Well, okay, I'd probably laugh probably really hard, I think.
Which is what he's looking for, I think, more than anything.
Yeah.
And
he's crying out for attention. He's a kid in need who's crying out for attention, thinks you're a jokester like he is, but maybe the joke that he was doing didn't land too well because you were too, you know.
Because I just didn't respond to it. And so for like 10 minutes. Yeah. And finally my wife's like, okay, he really...
was doing it for 10 minutes straight?
Yes.
Oh my God, his fingers cramped up halfway through and he couldn't pull them down probably.
Did you feel his hands in your face or anything?
Well, I can tell that I guessed what he was doing. If not that, some kind of gesture that would be shocking. That would be sensational.
Yeah.
Like, cause he was right. Like I could feel that he was walking like backwards right in front of me for over a block or two.
This is crazy.
And then there's like a couple other people with us that are in this missionary training. Yeah. And then some people from the church, and everybody's just like, okay, this is what it's like in this neighborhood. So yeah. Like just roll with it.
What year was this? This is important.
2004.
Okay.
2005.
The fact that he had a attention span to do that for 10 minutes straight during that year's that's a good sign.
Would not happen today, right?
No, yeah. They do it for like 2 minutes, put on TikTok and walk on, and that was that, you know? So there know, so, there's nothing like the good old days, I guess.
So finally my wife is like, okay, he really can't see, like, this, he's not faking it. And I think after 10 minutes, the young man, I'll say, because he's growing up fast in that neighborhood, the young man was like, okay, like, he, okay. And more, I don't know if he was disappointed that I couldn't see, or he was disappointed that the shocking joke didn't get more of a reaction.
Yeah. Man, that kid, I don't know if he woke up that day and was like, I'm going to do this. Or,
no.
He just probably had so much confidence in that joke in the beginning. And then just seeing, I would have loved to see the fade of his face as like the minutes pass. And it's just like, are you serious? This guy's not going to give me any reaction whatsoever.
Yeah, Chandler, what would you think? You're watching this like, oh my goodness.
I think that I would be absolutely bewildered, but I don't know how you can like try to do like any sort of joke for like 10 minutes and it not land.
the harder you push, finally like, it comes all the way like, full no, circle like, and it, now it's working it, because it's gone so
you know
far.
What? I would only give it a minute.
You would.
Didn't
you try that once the other day? Wait, didn't Chandler try that the other day?
Who told you about that?
Or was that? Or were you yelling at somebody else that was walking up to us saying, why are you doing... Didn't you say that the other day? Like, why are you giving Andy the finger?
Oh, I did do that.
It works when you can do it for a second, but yeah. But it, going on and on for 10 minutes. But I think that does illustrate
perseverance,
something.
Perseverance, you know, builds character.
But it does illustrate something.
It's a weird
example. Hey, you know, God used a donkey. He used a little kid with, you know, double barrel fingers. What are you going to do, right?
I don't know if that's what it illustrates, but it demonstrates that people don't always know what to do with disability. Yeah. Sometimes they overreact. They're like, oh, let me overhelp you. And then other times they're like, oh, you're not really... And they'll say stuff like this to me. Oh, I don't even think of you as blind. And I'm sure other disabilities, they say similar things. And it's like, well, I'm glad you don't think of me as that, but or that somehow I feel like somebody normal to you as opposed to this abnormality. But I am blind. And so let's not reduce a person to only how you can imagine what a human is. Like, oh, you're human, and I don't even think of you as having this quote-unquote defect or this thing, which is just a differentiated way of living in the world. So it's just interesting how people really have discomfort. And then this shocking example is how somebody might react, like, hey, and other friends will do it in different ways, or people try and come around it in different ways. But with that, we have a lot to investigate as we've been doing this series on disability theology. And today we're investigating some things in New Testament on Jesus and Paul, and even a little bit about the eunuch. And we have Anna Rebecca Solovag joining the podcast. So we're going to transition over to hear what she has to help us.
I was stuck in a labyrinth, called it a palace. He brought me out and gave me eyes to see.
Well, I want to welcome Dr. Anna Rebecca Solovag to our conversation here on Blind Faith. And I just want to thank you so much for coming to join us digitally through the medium of these digital conversations we can have in a podcast. So thank you so much for coming to be with us.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
I am thrilled. And it's just, it's kind of fun to think I'm talking to somebody in Norway while I'm here in Southern California. But I want to introduce you, and as we do, and sometimes in the podcast we have our co-host, but for the nature of when we could do this interview, I'm flying solo, but that's okay. And I want to introduce you as I do. It's more organically, and so I'll ask you to share a little bit about where you are and what you do. Since I cannot read a bio, but my reason of bringing you in is because and the guests I brought in are meaningful to my work. I did my PhD in the area of Bible disability and mission, and when it comes to Bible, such an emerging field in the inner relation between Bible and disability, and certainly there's a few that are writing on Paul. So I spent time with those authors, but your work, just when I came to it, it was just a really fresh and interesting approach. And so, Rebecca, you wrote a book, Negotiating the Disabled Body, and that we'll talk about a little bit. But tell us what else you're doing now. Where are you now, and what things are you working on?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me on this podcast. So I'm a New Testament scholar. I teach the Bible in a university here in Norway. It's a private Christian university called VID Specialized University. And we have a theology program, and I am in the theology program. And one of my research interests for the past 10 plus years has been disability theology and disability and the Bible, basically. And that's also why I wrote this this book, which is also about representations of disability in the New Testament and in some other early Christian texts.
Can you say the name of the school one more time?
VID Specialized University. So it's VID, capital V, capital I, capital D. It's an acronym, VID.
And what does VID stand for? Just for my curiosity.
Yeah, it doesn't really work in English because the acronym is for Norwegian.
It's okay, it's Norwegian.
Yeah. So it's a V for scientific, vitenskapelig, I for international, so that's the same, and D for diaconal, because we have a strong both diaconal and missional tradition. Our school was founded in 2016, but we all go further back as a school of mission and theology here in Stavanger, where I am, on the west coast of Norway, and a school of diakonia, diaconal work within the church in Oslo. So those two merged, and so we are both missional and diaconal in our theological approach, you could say.
Say diaconal, and yeah. What is diaconal?
That's from the Greek word diakonia.
I was wondering. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it's in Norwegian and Lutheran circles, it's a term that is used for Christian care and outreach, basically.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what I was wondering, but since I'm not in Norway to know, like, that's what... I wasn't sure if that's what you were saying or not saying, so I wanted to clarify. And then the international. So is this a school that has students from many places then?
Well, we do have some international students. Our kind of lookout is also international. As I mentioned, one of the founding schools was a mission school. So we have always had kind of a global focus for our theology and Christian outreach. So we still train theologians who go out as missionaries, and many of my colleagues have actually worked as missionaries. So we have strong relationships with institutions in the global south, particularly in Africa and Asia.
Well, fantastic. That intrigues me on many levels, and maybe in another day we could talk about world Christianity.
And you're interested in mission, right?
Oh, yeah, in mission. So I more and more appreciate the field of mission and mission studies in terms of world Christianity and what's happening in Africa and Asia and Latin America. But that's a side topic for the conversation we're at here. So I want to ask you something we ask our guests, and because it's one of the ethos of the podcast is all scholarship is biography. That saying our situatedness, our experiences, our story is where the questions bubble up from that we ask of the text. If we can come to the discipline of New Testament studies, is how we come to the text comes from our experiences. And maybe some will say, no, it's objective, but the reality is it's not. So what could you share with us, and in particular for the topic of this podcast season yeah. one, or your book, Negotiating the Disabled Body, Negotiating Disabled Bodies. What brought you to that topic? It's newer in the field of biblical studies, so I'm excited that something brought somebody to it. But what when there's so many things being written in many ways, what brought you to disability in the Bible?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, because I am temporarily able-bodied. I'm not born or have lived with a disability myself, but I have always interested.
I love how you said that. I'm sorry. I loved how you said temporarily able-bodied. I love how you said that, because one of my favorite quotes from I'm forgetting her name now. That's so bad. But that we all, whether by accident or sickness or forget the third one, but we all will, or by age, accident, sickness, mm-hmm. or age, will be disabled. So her name will come to me later, and I'll bring it up again. But so I love that you said temporarily able.
And that's, of course, an important awareness, I think, that I'm not. That's something that's special about kind of the identity part of living with a disability, that it's something that can change. And for some people, it changes on a daily basis. For some people, it's a merger. For some people, you know, it can happen from one day to the next that you're in an accident or something. So so I think that's a very important perspective. And that's, again, then different from, for example, gender, right? You're born with a gender, and most people stay with that gender the rest of their lives. And for me, reading and doing theology from my identity position, from my place, started out with this identity that had to do with gender as a woman. I was interested in women in the Bible, and passages in the Bible that seem problematic for women. And so I have, ever since I was in, you know, an undergrad student, I have been interested in these more gender and feminist perspectives on the Bible and on theology. So when I did my PhD, that was kind of
can I pause you
basic starting point.
Can I pause you as you're unfolding this a little bit? I really found some rich writing and perspective from feminist writings, because at least with Paul, before I was really able to get further into people writing on disability and Paul in particular, the authors, and I apologize to them again, the ones that were really helpful, their names are escaping me. It was Alison Kafer, who I was quoting a moment ago. Alison Kafer, who said, disability, we're all going to encounter that at some point.
That's right. I read her, yeah.
But is it Alexandra Brown and at Baylor and some other authors, and I'm forgetting their names, but with the idea of Paul's masculinity, that he didn't live up to the quote unquote masculinity picture. And so I was like, oh, okay, masculinity, that's the issue here. When you're Paul, you're weak to look at, you're weak to your speech is weak, these things that they're complaining about with him. Well, that's in terms of masculinity. And I thought, okay, well, masculinity, then there's a fruitful road to go to disability. But I find it interesting that you mentioned that's where you kind of started too, and reading the Bible from that perspective. So keep on going. I really I'm listening.
Yeah, and you mentioned this idea about Paul and his kind of not perfect masculinity, and maybe that has something to do with disability. And that's basically where I arrived at too, working with texts. I realized that gender as a kind of identity marker or something that helps you understand the texts, it's not enough, especially if you're asking questions about bodies and identities. And so my kind of developed approach has been what is often referred to as intersectionality, where you think about someone's identity as at the intersection of various kind of parts of your identity, whether it's your gender, your sexuality, your ability or disability, your race or ethnicity, all of these things kind of merge and has
Can I pause you here just for a moment? I think since you said it, I want to address it maybe a little more head on, because where we exist here in Southern California, we're in the shadow, and not everybody's in the same shadow, but there's many shadows depending who you listen to. But John MacArthur's just down the road, and when that became an issue for him and those that are of that ilk to say, oh, intersectionality is blah blah blah, to the point of it's against the gospel, they'll say these things, or that's why he doesn't want a woman or a minority to be a Bible interpreter. I'm not asking you to comment on him, but the word intersectionality, I think to some, became a word to like to say, oh, we're not going to listen to people if they do that kind of theory. So I found it fruitful as a way to ask questions. It doesn't mean it's the only or best or whatever, but I'd love for you to say a little bit more of how that is a fruitful approach to interpreting a text.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I wasn't aware that someone found that problematic.
That's okay.
I think it's very useful to ask those kinds of questions. I mean, just if we think about biblical characters, the people that we meet in the Bible, it helps us understand who they are and what their position was in the world. If you think, for example, about the Syrophoenician woman who comes to Jesus because she has a daughter who's referred to as demon-possessed, and she asks Jesus for healing, how can we understand her? And how can we understand how she thought her kind of identity position was when she met someone like Jesus?
Oh no! Now we're talking about some very fun things for me, and so I'm gonna go on the tangent with you. I love this story so much.
I
do. And since you're here, I'm gonna ask you questions that I know I have some sense of how I speak about it when I preach this text or teach it. And I teach a class on the Gospels. So, but this character is such an interesting character in one of the Gospels, Syrophoenician woman, and another one, I don't think they refer to her exactly that way, but
she's first referred to as a Canaanite woman,
yes,
in the Gospel of Matthew, and a Syrophoenician woman in the Gospel of Mark, and those are the two, I think, Gospels that refer to that story, maybe in Luke as well, I'm not sure.
And I think it's Philo or Josephus who talks about the people from Tyre and Sidon are like the most reviled, like as far as those and Jewish Palestinian characters. And so then here's Jesus with this character who comes to find him in a house. Like the whole setting is fascinating, that Jesus is kind of pulled away and in a private setting. And then here she is, she shows up. We don't really know how she got in. Maybe so many questions, but here she is. And then the one that I think people misinterpret so much is that, oh wait, why is Jesus calling her a dog? Like, so I'd love for you to if you're talking about the situatedness of characters in the Bible, which led us into this narrative, tell us more about her situatedness as a Syrophoenician woman, and then the interplay between her and Jesus and the metaphor of a dog, because when I think of that, it certainly is derogatory. I mean, I could mention so many examples from the past 20, 30, 40 years of people using that term, especially maybe in places like Egypt or that region of the world. And I'm thinking of when the assassination in the early 80s of the leader of Egypt and this whole idea of the people calling him a dog or whatever, like, so this sense of this is a term even today in that region of the Mediterranean is a super derogatory term, and so the interplay with Jesus and this woman and the dog eating this crab. So yeah, unpack that a moment. I know we're sidetracking, but yeah.
No, but it's not necessarily a sidetrack, because it taking this kind of intersectional lens helps us unpack this story, because we can ask about what has her, is the relationship between her and Jesus, what does it have, has it to do with gender, has it to do with these various, that she's from a different ethnicity, is she a woman who's of a higher class than Jesus? She's from this more Greek, she's also referred to as Greek in that story, Greek speaking, which could mean that she is of a higher class, she's of the ruling class. And she, even though maybe Jews look down on Syrophoenicians, that doesn't mean that Syrophoenicians thought that they were beneath Jews, right?
Right.
So I'm not sure that we can say for sure exactly, you know, historically what it was, but we can explore different ways it can be understood.
And
I think scholars have also gone in different directions there. But I think that she probably seeks out Jesus because she thinks that he's some kind of holy man. And the story says that she kneels down or kind of throws herself on the ground before Jesus, and she calls him Lord. So that is also kind of a terminology of respect. So she seeks him because she thinks that he has something that she needs, and as a man, you know, she shows him also respect as kind of the inferior sex or gender in that historical context, showing him respect by kneeling down and kind of being showing that she's in a way inferior to him. But he doesn't call her dog.
Right. That's what I want you to help us understand. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I'm not going to completely exonerate this, because, you know, there are some aspects of what he says that is kind of problematic. And I think that she actually turns him around. She persuades him otherwise. But at least he provides her with a puzzle. He kind of opens up this scenario that there isn't enough food for everyone. And then if you're in a scenario where there isn't enough food for the children, you shouldn't throw that food to the dogs. That's basically what he says, right? You shouldn't throw the children's food to the dogs. But kind of the underlying notion then is that she represents the dogs rather than the children. And why does she do that? Is it because of her ethnicity, right? Are the Jews the children that deserves the food? And are then the Syrophoenicians the dogs that do not deserve food? And basically what she says is, her argument is that there is enough for everything, that, you know, whatever falls on, you know, there's too much. It's when it's thrown, the children don't even eat everything. So something falls on the ground and, you know, that should be made available for the dogs. And that can then become an imagery of the gospel being, you know, the gospel is for everyone. There's enough. God's grace is enough, in a way, for everyone.
Yeah, and she helps teach us that picture.
Yes,
she helps teach us, and I say us individually as a male figure myself. She helps teach us, even as men reading the story, that the grace of God is bigger than what maybe I thought it was. Yeah.
Yeah, so she's kind of an interpreter, a theologian that's reasoning, and so in a way, maybe, you know, at least she and Jesus in a way together arrives at this reasoning that there is enough, because the story ends with him healing her daughter. So Jesus maybe accepts, maybe he knew all along that there is enough for everything. So there's also healing for the daughter, in a way.
Thank you for listening to Blind Faith. Now, a word from our sponsor. Are you ready to hear who's sponsoring this podcast?
Yes. Yeah.
Have you ever been to the Mall of America?
No.
Have you ever wanted to be the Mall of America?
No. Yes.
Oh.
Okay, one yes, one no. But what if I told you DeLeo Brothers Pizza? Okay.
I one changed of the my answer.
One of the best pizzas in all of Minnesota, as voted by the people that vote for that. And here's their slogan. In garlic, we crust.
Oh.
Now you want to go to the Mall of America, don't you?
I'm going to the Mall of America right now.
Let's take a flight.
And they have a second location opening in Seattle. So look it up on this thing called Google. And DeLeo Brothers Pizza, bringing you Blind Faith Podcast. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now back to our regularly scheduled programming. And so that really helps illustrate, I think, an important piece to the what you're saying about intersectionality. Like, our situatedness is not unidimensional. I'm not just this character.
Exactly.
And there's a part of me that is gendered. There's a part of me that's this. With blindness, there's a part of me that has that situation. There's the socioeconomic situation is something so we are multidimensional characters. And our lives intersect a number of experiences. So the intersectionality approach to who are the characters of the Bible and the writers, the authors, and the context, and my reading. So that, thank you for helping with that illustratively. And then that led you little further down the line. Oh, go ahead.
Could I just add, because I think there's one more aspect, Andy, in this kind of intersectional perspective, because you can't just define... You can't decide what your identity is, in a way.
Oh, yeah.
In a given society, people will read you.
Yes.
And people will place you in boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And that has happened to me as a woman. I'm sure that has happened to you also.
Oh, yes.
And that also happened, you know, during Jesus's time. I mean, you could identify however you wanted as a leper, but if you were a leper, people will put you in a certain box, right?
Mm-hmm.
So intersectionality also helps us understand how certain people are placed in certain boxes and how that there's also kind of a complex hierarchy around that. You can't, if you're a woman, that will place you in some kind of category. That will make you inferior vis-a-vis men. But if you're a rich woman or a Greek-speaking woman, it may, you know, so it can become complex, but it's not, you can't decide on it yourself. It's also given kind of in a society and you need to negotiate. That's a term I like. identities in a way.
I think this is helpful as we're talking about Bible and disability. Maybe we're going into the weeds a little much. That's okay, because I think we're explaining it. But I think people are able to follow along. But I think it's so valuable to interrogate this social situation, the social location of where the story was or where the text was written. David Powell, he was professor of New Testament, or is professor of New Testament, well, now dean at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and he wrote an essay in a Festschrift to I think it was for Doug Moo, but on Romans, it might have been Grant Osborne, it was whatever, some Festschrift, and his contribution to this essay on overall edited volume on writing commentaries. He was talking about Romans 13, but his point that he drew out was one of the tasks is to do the contextual work of what was going on in that situation in the context of the text being written. And then the other side is also then to help interpret it to us in the context where we are. And he made a point that few scholars do well at knowing the context of what it was written. And he's writing in an evangelical context, but so few take serious that what it takes to investigate the social context of the social cultural background. And then also few do well at investigating or probing the context in which we live in today. And so we approach the Bible sometimes as like this text that's just out there. We can read it, we can interpret it, we can spiritualize it, whatever. And so the work you've done and others that come to this and help us get the social cultural background of the text, it is so enriching to those of us who are wanting to know, okay, well, what is happening here? How do we know what is being said? Because we live in such a different world. And so some of us come to the Bible and we're like overwhelmed because how do I get into what they're saying? Because I don't even know these characters. Who are they? Where are they? And then I think one other piece I want to add to that is it's not just 2,000 years of history. And I kept remembering this was a quote from a book David Bosch wrote on transforming mission. But he was quoting some other scholars that maybe the harder thing for us in the so-called West, Europe, North America, so on. We read not just from 2,000 years of history, but from a socioeconomic place of privilege where the New Testament authors and characters were more often than not not in that place of privilege. And so as you're speaking about this, like one of my favorite books, I'll probably mention it here and there, Jesus and the Disinherited by Howard Thurman. Like we forget that Jesus was this kind of character. Dispossessed, disinherited, dislocated, oppressed by the Roman Empire, so on. Other characters that were oppressive to his situation, and so on. And we turn these characters in our churches today, Jesus, Paul, into like superheroes. Certainly, Jesus did supernatural things, but we create this thing like and because we live in often our churches are in suburbs and we live in a place of affluence and so on. We think, well, we can just do ministry wonderfully like they did because we have all this like place of privilege and power. And so we don't read the stories from like the actual nitty gritty of where they lived and what the air they breathed and the dirt they walked in.
Yeah. And As a New Testament scholar, I love all of that. I love exploring the various characters and you know the background and to learn about that time and place. But I'm also very aware that you know my interests and my questions, I'm asking them from my lived experience from my space, and when it comes to disability as
yes, thank you. That's what we're here for. Thank you.
So we've
meandered and now we're
one
here.
One of the really important things about disability is that we understand disability very differently today than I think that they did in Jesus' time.
Can you say that one more time?
They didn't even have a word for disability,
right?
So how can we understand these stories, these biblical texts, and how can they make meaning for us? How can we read them in good and beneficial ways? We need to understand them, but of course also interpret them so that they make meaning for us and are relevant in our context.
Well, and that's one of the things to, as a caution for people like myself, to not read into the story disability from a perspective from today, but in many ways, and you can help me, disability is socially constructed in many ways. So it's just a word we use to describe an experience from today. And so characters in the New Testament may have encountered similar experiences of being disabled or by society or experiencing sickness or such chronic illness, that the things that would be what we'd call a quote unquote disability and impairment. Talk to me about how then you moved towards disability in the context of the characters of the Bible.
Yeah. Well, so we have already talked about the Syrophoenician woman, right? And she has a child who, according to the text, is demon possessed. That's not kind of a disability category or health category that we operate with today. or those who do kind of from a Christian context, context think that there are demons. We think that it's something else than mm-hmm. health, right? That it's then it's just some kind of possession by the devil. But in that context, in Jesus's time, that was kind of a health category, and it could make you even blind people are said to be, mm-hmm. you know, they have a demon that made them blind or a demon that made them deaf, which we would think is, you know, very weird or hard to understand today. So how do we make meaning of those? You know, those kinds of categories.
No, don't move too quickly there. I think that that's something we need to consider. And myself, in a Pentecostal background, and a lot of the spaces I move in are Pentecostal. Yeah. The question of healing and so on are things we wrestle with. But demon possession, we don't put it in the category of healing. We put it in the category of of casting out a demon or like
exorcism.
Yes, exorcism. And so so even in the way we categorize these things in our interpretive lens isn't talking about it in the terms of healthcare, sickness. So yeah, unpack that a little bit more. You probably have another example or two.
Yeah, I can do that because I think that in order to understand how people thought about health, illness, disability in antiquity or in Jesus's time, it's important and to kind of know what the kind of medical paradigm was, because we today, at least in the Western world, we have a medical understanding. We know how the body works, and that's supposedly, very clear to
supposedly,
us, right?
Supposedly we know how the body works.
Yeah. Well, I think that most of us, at least, how can I put it, we have kind of the same basic understanding. So we leave it to the doctors, but we believe that we should go to the doctor, right?
Yep.
So in Jesus's time, people had... there were two kind of competing understandings.
I'm sorry, I just there had to say that supposedly we know, and there's still much, and part of that was to say there's still much that science and medicine is learning, but there, but we also live right now in a context where so many are questioning the so-called medical consensus.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's...
So maybe it's some not of so that different
it, some questions are worth. Some questions are worth asking, but then sometimes it's like, wait, what are we going to do? We're going to just tear it all down and then we're left with no understanding of anything. So we live in a moment of, at least in the U.S., where so much is trying to be undone because of suspicion of the medical... the complex.
So let me put it a little bit differently then. In the same way as we today have kind of competing understanding of what health is, some believe in a more kind of traditional biomedical Western medicine paradigm. Mm-hmm. Others think in other terms. In Jesus' time, there were also kind of competing understandings of how the body works. And one of them was that you get sick because something from outside enters you.
Yeah.
For example, a demon.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not something that only Jews believed, but a lot of peoples in the Mediterranean, ancient Mediterranean world believed that you could be sick if something entered you. But Jews... because they believed in one God who was good, they also believed that any demon that would enter you would be bad, would be from the devil or Satan. But for example, Greeks or Romans, they believed in lots of different gods, so gods could enter you, and that so you could get a positive demon in a way. You could be demon possessed in a positive way. For example, if you were an oracle. So you have this idea about illness, even being blind or deaf or having a crooked back or being what we would think more like mentally disabled.
Yeah.
Have some kind of more like depression, or, you know, we have, you know, these various categories, but those who believe in this kind of possession paradigm or invasion paradigm, mm-hmm. they would think that everything, all of this can be explained by external bodies, you know, invisible bodies entering a human body. And then the competing medical understanding would be kind of the ancient doctors in the tradition of Hippocrates.
Yeah, like, yeah, right.
So they had kind of started developing this different notion of illness that kind of excluded demons from the equation. So they did not believe that something could enter you, but that you had to make sure that you had a body in balance. If you mm-hmm, were sick, mm-hmm. you were imbalanced. Maybe you had eaten the wrong kind of food. Maybe you had exercised too much. Maybe you had lived an, you know, excessive lifestyle, or just eaten things that wasn't according to your body type, because they had these four different body types, like phlegmatic, etc., etc. So right. that was a different understanding of medicine or health.
Mm-hmm.
And both of these are different from what we believe in today. And so we can project our understanding of what exorcism and demon possession is to the biblical text, because that's something different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think that we have to be really careful when we read these texts to be aware that we think about this differently today. And so maybe we have to, if we're looking for kind of the theological meaning of a text, it might not be in this understanding of how the body works. We can still believe in a Western medical understanding of how the body works and find the theological meaning on a different level in the text.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Does that make sense, or
yes.
was it too complicated?
No, that I think that makes a lot of sense, and I'm just mm-hmm. I'm just thinking of you mentioned mental health in the way that it was understood, like, again, that's a lot of times a modern idea of mental health is so different from madness, so to speak,
yeah.
in the way that people would have talked about a character in the time of Jesus or in the Mediterranean world there. So, I thought some of the stuff I really appreciated that you brought out in your work on negotiating disabled bodies related to that as well. And I think there's just some really fruitful things and how that helps us think about the world today. But so I wonder if you could unpack a little bit of things, whether with Jesus or even with Paul. And I found it fascinating as you were addressing some of the criticisms Paul was addressing, and I think it was in 2 Corinthians 5, I forget exactly the text now, but you were addressing Paul even in the idea of, like, this guy's a madman. what's going on here? So if you feel comfortable jumping into a specific text of 2 Corinthians, that's fine. Otherwise, with some broad brush strokes, talking to us about Jesus and Paul and these characters and how they were misunderstood in their time, maybe, or understood, and they were subverting.
Yeah.
They were subverting something.
Well, I think I've read parts of your dissertation too, Annie, and I think that we have kind of common interest in trying to figure out, you know, who was Paul and how was he perceived by the people around him, and how was he even, you know, how did his enemies even talk him down and claiming that he, you know, talking about maybe a disability that he had to undermine his mission.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we can see traces in Paul's letters of how he is trying to defend himself, because we see traces in both 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians mm-hmm. of Paul saying that, well, people, you know, say that I am weak. People say, people said that he was maybe crazy. And so he used that, kind of took that and used it against them and just claimed. He claimed weakness. He claimed madness and said, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
You can say that I am, and I agree with you that I am, but I still have mm-hmm. something.
Yeah, right.
Because, and I think that is, to me, it's one of the most important kind of interpretations of what the cross or Jesus's death and resurrection means is what yes. Paul does in the Corinthian correspondence, because he says that Jesus, through dying on the cross and showing complete weakness,
mm-hmm.
Turns everything upside down.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus is willing to be the lowest of the low, and so all human categories are completely opposite. Those who are strong mm-hmm. are actually weak. Those who are seen to be weak, they are the ones who actually have God's power. Those who are, you know, seem to be mad, or we think are mad, including Paul, who they uh-huh. said were mad,
uh-huh.
those are the ones who have God's insights. And I think that is a very, it's a deep insight that comes from an experience of disability, I think.
The cross, I think it all comes through in the Corinthian correspondence of the cross,
yeah.
being the just there in the background of everything Paul is saying, especially in 2 Corinthians as we have it, and he's addressing so many things that they're like, well, if you suffer, you're suffering because the gods wouldn't allow you to suffer unless you are doing something wrong. And so why are we going to follow you? And then these on and on, he's addressing these things like, but that's okay. He's like, that's okay. That's okay. Mm-hmm. Because it's not about me. It's about the cross of Christ. And he's communicating yeah. something that in many ways is madness to, like, who's going to go to the cross to turn things upside down, right? Like the whole mm-hmm. idea of the cross is a little bit hard to get our arms around, or especially in that world, hard for a Greek in that time to say, oh yeah, God's going to die on the cross. That does, and that mm-hmm. like that just doesn't it doesn't compute. And so there's a bit yeah. of it that is madness, and yet not yeah. and yet not madness, because it's well, the wisdom of this world is turned foolish. And so these things that, yeah,
and
there's
I think
just
that Jesus
that,
I think Jesus when we read the Gospels, also even in his life, kind of embodies this insight through his meal practices of eating with the marginalized,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
through his healings of various people who, through healing them, kind of included them in society again, or saw them, or mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. met them, and saw who they were, what their identity was, and recognized them.
I like that you said he saw them. I was talking to yeah. somebody yesterday, just around the table. We were just sitting and talking, and they were asking me lots of questions about what does it mean to be blind? What do people say this? Do this? Mm. This happen? Like, just really curious and genuine, and a nice, authentic conversation, trying to understand. And she's like, well, what is it that you see most? Are people like, do they say mean things to you? I'm like, well, not really that, but neglect, overlooked. Like, that's usually yeah. the thing. People just don't see. Well, and being ironic, but like, they don't see people with disabilities. I mean, they see, maybe see me with a white cane. It's kind of when I come in front, when I confront them, but it's easy for somebody to pass by and ignore. But other disabilities, cognitive impairments, so on and so on. Like, there's a lot of things we can just look the other way and not see. And Jesus saw these people.
Yeah.
He saw these people. He ate with them. He healed them to bring them back into community. There's so much of the gospel is right there in that, bringing people from that are excluded into the into the community, into the kingdom of God. But then there's so but what I found enriching with Paul is what you said, like, I'm mad, sure, I'm whatever you want to say, disabled, weak, but what I found fascinating is because basically they're trying to undermine him, like you said, they're undermining his mission. But it's these terms like discarded, thrown out, neglected, like they just would rather like discard anything he has to say because he doesn't have anything to say because of who he is in his embodied, like the way he's saying it, the way he's embodying what he's saying. We don't have to listen to him. He's nothing. He's worth throwing away.
Yeah. And to me, I think he, through his letters and through the Corinthian correspondence, he has given us as Christians a unique gift in being kind of the first generation of interpreting Jesus's message. And I think that this is kind of it's a very profound insight. And I also think I'm glad that we have this in the Paul's perspectives in the New Testament. And in a way, we have the voice of also a person with a disability who was not healed, because that's, I think, what he says when he talks about this so-called thorn in the flesh, right?
Yeah.
I think he's talking about an experience of asking God for healing and not being healed. Do you think that? Or how do you read that?
Those
verses?
I tried to sidestep that as much as I could because there's so much literature arguing why it's this or why it's that. It's one of the most like confounding texts to come to, and yet I feel like people don't take it serious either. They just want to interpret it. And so there's so many things. I really liked Adela Yarborough Collins' work on Paul's weakness and thorn in the flesh, and and using early church fathers to. It could have been malaria. It could have been, it could have been epilepsy. It could have, and a number of, because this person interpreted it this way, this person interpreted it this way, and she kind of drew out, and I'm forgetting which one was which, but
well, more it's not so Greek important to me what it was, as much as it is kind of the insight and also that experience. So in Jesus's meeting with these various people that he heals, we have that, we have experiences of healing, and Jesus meeting particular individuals and seeing them and including them. In Paul, we also have biblical witness of someone who becomes extremely important for early Christian mission, who has an experience of some kind of bodily disability in my reading. I don't know what it is, but he asks for healing, he doesn't get it, and he still has a role to play and has theological insight through that bodily lived experience. And all of those are kind of biblical voices on what it means to be a Christian, and what it means to be a person with a weak body, right?
Since you asked me, I'm not trying to pass peer review article or defend a dissertation here in this space. I'll just come more out with it. I think it's, I find it interesting that people come up with other ideas that he could be talking about this or that or the other persecution or whatever other ones are out there. And there's evidence in the Greek that maybe he's not addressing this or that, so on, so on. But I find it interesting that we almost do interpretive gymnastics to get to something that isn't a bodily disability.
Yes.
And so on the one hand, even if it is persecution, there is something disabling in the sense that people are persecuted. There is something.
But he has been beaten. He has got the however many lashes.
Wounds and scars. Yeah.
So persecution isn't just terror and fright and having to run away. It's also physically breaking down someone's body, and that has happened to Paul.
So I could even make the argument that no matter what the thing that initiated all this could, there's a disabling effect, but I do think it was a bodily impairment. I don't want to make the argument of what it was, because in my reading, he's writing to a people he knows. They clearly would know what it is. They're not going, hey, what did he mean when he said thorn? Was he talking about, was he talking about a thorn in this spiritual sense? Was he talking about a thorn in some physical? They knew him. They knew what he was talking about. And so like he didn't have to explain it to them, and that's who he's writing to. It's us years later going, wait, was it a thorn in this way, and was it just Satan just kept persecuting him, and so God didn't free him from that just to keep him humble. I just find it almost laughable that we find every other way to understand it than it could have been a bodily impairment or bodily disability. They clearly said he's got a weak body. Like he's weak in appearance. He's weak in appearance. Like, so what does that mean? It certainly means something related to a embodied thing. And then if we, this is maybe people argue yes or no in how we exegete something, but in Galatians, he's saying you would give me your good eyes for mine. And he says to them, I in Galatians 4, he says to them, I came to you in sickness, which you, maybe he was going there because they had some kind of medicine for whatever eye thing he had. But for whatever reason he went there, he's like, I came to you in sickness. And what in the world, if we're coming with the gospel message, we don't usually come with like, hey, I'm coming to you in, and I also have this problem first to address with you, but I'm today as Americans with resource and expertise, because we've been trained a lot, we don't go to places to bring the gospel and say, hey, I'm coming with sickness. Except I did. I went as somebody with blindness. And so I related so much to what Paul's saying there. I came to you in sickness, whether that was like the eye condition that he's like, you would give me your good eyes. And whatever that is, he's coming to them saying, hey, I need your help. I have this vulnerability. But as you were in this reciprocity of back and forth, let me also share with you the gospel. And we just don't read it slowly enough to see that there's this process unfolding as he's bringing the gospel. It's embodied in somebody with a bodily ailment or bodily something, and it seems like he's describing in Galatians of an eye condition, and he's like, look what big letters I write with, and then I run, this is where I don't know how to substantiate all this, but I run with it. Like, well, it also shows how much he understood the body of Christ, and he's always traveling with companions. He's got people that he's dictating to. Yeah. Like what it might explain a lot of other things of his experience of and why he was always mentoring people, because they were with him helping him.
Yeah, and I think that what you say about reciprocity, I think there's so much to learn there in how, you know, how we can be, you know, church together with all our different weaknesses and various bodies and various insights, rather than thinking that, you know, it's just those, you know, perfect people that can, you know, be leaders or do something special.
Wow.
I think he really lived that. And I think we can see it in Acts too, if we look closely enough, that he's a person as you said, he kind of, you know, works in these teams. He works with these various women. They all have a, you know, part to play.
Well, I personally just like trying to find out how to write it more of a disability hermeneutic, and whether it's a particular disability that Paul has in these moments or other spaces, whether you brought us to Acts, whether it's the eunuch who is from Ethiopia, who's but the indicating part of the text is he's a eunuch, and what does that mean about his embodied experience? He has inferiority in this way and that. He wouldn't have been allowed in worship and so on. But these ideas of powerlessness because of an embodied experience. And so disability in the quote unquote sense of how it is a disempowering thing that society does to people. I think the disability hermeneutic allows us to come to the text in a way that I don't want to romanticize it, but it allows us to come to the text with curiosity and humility and an openness that sometimes we come to the text with this sense of confidence and we know exactly what it's saying and we can tell you this is what it means. And so I just found it so helpful to let go of some of the assumptions I might have had about Paul or others and more ask more questions. What is he saying here? What's going on here?
Yeah, and you should be careful to get me started on the Ethiopian eunuch, because I've worked a lot with that character as well. I just wanted to tell you, did you know that I once wrote an article called No Nuts, No Problem?
I would love to get you your article now, because I feel like there's so much there that helps us think about questions we have today on gender and sexuality, and we're like, this is such a new, nobody's ever been dealing with this like we are now. Like, people did things to their bodies.
Just one thing.
People did things to their own bodies or to other people's bodies for thousands of years. Like, so.
Yeah.
So tell me that again. No nuts. Wait, no nuts. No. Tell the title again. Tell me the title again. No nuts. No. Say that one more time.
No nuts. No problem.
Okay.
There's one brief thing about the Ethiopian eunuch.
Yeah,
and
please.
I think that he is also an example of what we see, also the character of Paul. He's an example of a disabled person who has a space in the body of Christ in a way. He becomes included without being healed, right?
Yeah.
The stigma of his disability is taken away when he is baptized.
Oh my goodness. This is such a, I feel like we've covered so much ground, but this is such a profound way to draw our conversation to a close. Stigma. I'm just going to say it again. Stigma. And this idea that's drawn from in disability studies, drawn from Irving Goffman and others, that stigma was like, in slavery when people were branded with and so stigma is such a vivid picture of this person, because who knows that he is that, except that somehow they all know, like nobody's they're not doing body checks, but they all know because of the way that they have to carry themselves and so on. So it's clear that he is this character, and Deuteronomy says you cannot be part of this, but then Isaiah says in the time to come, these people who will come to the house of prayer, and then it is actually fulfilled through this character in Acts 8. And then I love what you just said, that the stigma is washed away in baptism. Or maybe you didn't say it exactly that way, but that isn't, it's not about healing this thing and going, okay, now you have...
His body isn't changed at all, but he is allowed to be a part of the people of God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe even I might problematize the word allowed. Like, he's welcome. He's brought
included
in.
He's in the body of Christ. Yeah, but there are different ways of saying it.
And I don't mean to pick on that one, on you with that, but I think that it's like, okay, well, we'll tolerate. That's not what you meant, but like,
no, yes, I'm
that's not
sorry,
what you meant. That's not what you meant at all. No, don't.
English.
Yeah, I'm putting you on the spot. I'm not meaning to do that. I think that I'm only problematizing it because I'm talking to an audience, a church, that it's not about like, okay, we'll make space for some people who are differently embodying their space here, but
I know you didn't mean that, but
I just want to say to the church, like, it's not about as a church, you can be here, but it's almost like, no, you are here and fully here.
Because the eunuch asks, right? He says, what is to prevent me from being baptized?
Mm-hmm.
And then the next thing that happens is that they go into the water together and he is baptized.
Mm-hmm.
There is clearly nothing to prevent him from being baptized. There is no reason whatsoever why he shouldn't become part of the body of Christ. So he is baptized next thing. The only thing he needs to do is, you know, to ask, can I be baptized? Of course. And then he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wish we could unpack that story so much more. I will look for your article and I'll link it in the notes to the podcast along with your book and link to you and your page with the faculty where you teach. And I just am so grateful. I'm so grateful that we could unpack so many things here. We probably got into a little bit of a conversation about intersectionality that I wasn't planning to bring you into, but I was so glad we did, because I think it mm-hmm. will help us in terms of so many other things we talk about in this podcast. Of all scholarship is biography, and so to bring our perspective, our place in, it's only natural. And so to actually be aware of who we are, where we're coming from, and who the characters we're reading, where they are, where they're coming from, is so helpful. And then, as we discussed, it's a natural step into the issues of disability and what is disablement and so on. So thank you so much for doing the work you did that helps us in terms of scholarship and myself in particular, but thank you for this conversation helping us and those listening process what it means to think of these issues as we read the text.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoy talking to you, Andy.
Thank you. It's been fun.
It certainly has.
This has been another episode of Blind Faith. Enjoy having you with us, and come stick around. If you like this one, give us a click like, and whatever platform you're on, give us a rating and go ahead and subscribe. We're glad you're here with us. We'll be with you again soon.